We were hoping for more damage between the Sangheili before we did this, Taryllis said. We knew the risk when we planned this operation, Hecabe said. It is time. The Sangheili must not get anywhere near this city before we are ready. Destroy them. I do not care what it costs. I will give the order myself, chieftain, said Taryllis. And call upon Phobane to begin the dig immediately, Hecabe added. There are hundreds of Ungoi still clearing rubble inside, Taryllis started. They are Ungoi. What does it matter? Need I remind you of the urgency of our charge, Taryllis? We barely have enough to feed ourselves. Our clans are starving back on Wariel, Hecabe snapped. I do not care about the cost of life. We've waited too long already. Begin.
Chapter 7. The bumblebee tumbled end over end. Jai grabbed a harness and held tight as his whole world spun. He looked up past where Adriana had wedged herself and forward to the cockpit. Mike! Jai felt like he was hanging in the air. The airlock turned into down and the cockpit up. Caro's surface flashing by the cockpit windows every few seconds. Then every second. Then everything blurred.
Thrusters fired, thumping and tossing Jai around.
Like flying a boot with a brick glued onto the side, Mike grunted.
A bulkhead screeched and cracked. Jai knew that the bumblebee was breaking apart high above the planet's atmosphere. Pieces shorn from its hull centimeter by centimeter. He glanced back at the injured civilian inside the harness, her legs jerking around in the chaos. With their armor lock, the Spartans might survive impact with the planet, but she'd be a bloody smear across whatever they hit. Miraculously, the bumblebee finally slowed its endless spinning as Mike managed to wrestle control of the vehicle. Then, with a last wobble and thump of the thrusters, it flattened out.
Apologies, everybody. That was a little rough, said Mike. How's the civvy?
Jai made his way over to her, grabbing harnesses as he went. There was blood pushing its way around the biofoam.
She's bleeding again.
A loud crunch and Jai lurched forward.
Sorry, air brakes, Mike said. Been trying to delay them as long as I could.
The clouds that had been far below seconds earlier now rose quickly toward them.
The structural integrity of the lifeboat is failing. I can't make it to the city. I'm just looking for a place to land at this point.
Understood. We're lucky we even got this far, Mike said, tapping touch panels near his knee. Not the first time we've jumped off a dying ship, though, Jai said, squatting down on the floor.
Not what I mean, Mike glanced back from the cockpit. Lucky to have woken up. We were on a Covenant ship. What does that mean? We should be dead, you know. I don't understand why they didn't just kill us in the pod when they came across us.
Jai took a deep breath. Given what they'd been ordered to do, he was just as shocked to wake up on a Sangheili ship alive.
I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I'm just trying to take this one moment at a time.
We're going to need to talk about Gliki. Mike started.
Not now.
Jai looked forward at Adriana, who clambered past him to sit in the very back of the lifeboat with the extra plasma rifles she'd liberated. She stared out the airlock window, somehow creating a separate world away from them both. She might as well have been in another star system.
Adriana?
No, she said.
Jai winced. She'd been there in the fight. That was all that mattered. They'd deal with all this later, after they got help for the wounded woman. Then they'd talk about Gliki. But right now it was a distraction, and distractions got you killed. The lifeboat popped loudly again and started to spin in a slow corkscrew.
Damn it, we're coming apart, Mike said. Hold on, I'm taking us down.
Vice Governor Lamar ran across the rooftop toward Elise and the waiting Pelican. In the distance, past the skyline of downtown Soraka, the Jirohanai cruiser hovered, blasting the ground beneath it with the tremendous energy of the ship's glassing beam. The air rippled all around what had once been the residential area of Soraka. It was turning slowly into a melted plain. They debated about whether the cruiser would then come for the rest of the city. But whenever it approached the pile of rubble the Jiral Hanai had turned into their fortified wall, it veered back toward the Ult Desert, evidently uninterested in the urban section of town. Why? Why the edge of the desert? What are they after? Are they simply biding time before they strike the rest of Soraka? Are they looking for something else? The fact that she hadn't the slightest clue gnawed at the back of her mind like a thorn she couldn't pluck free. That was an unknown, though. She could only work with the known quantities she had in her possession, and try to protect those who had survived. She'd just have to leave the Jiral Hanai's motivations on the back burner.
"Governor! Governor!" Lamar shouted.
She stopped by the Pelican's ramp.
"Lamar, what are you doing up here?"
"This is a bad idea," he said, taking her by the arm and moving in closer.
"No, Lamar. They need to see me," she said, gently pushing him off her. "The militia. People in the bunkers. I'm going to put my own eyes on the situation. Hold up in a control room. Buried deep underground. I'm not going to be able to understand what's going on from there."
"The structure of command needs to be maintained during conflict," Lamar replied. "Head of state needs to be protected."
"You'll be head of state if I get killed," Elise said.
Lamar bit his lip and shook his head. "The people elected you to lead, not me. I apologize, Governor, for saying this, but with all due respect, you can't run away from this and jeopardize Soraka's stability for the sake of your curiosity. The people need their governor safe if we're going to survive this mess. This is your duty."
He looked genuinely upset to have said it, and it felt like a slap to the face.
Elise started to turn away, but Lamar leaned in even closer, so Elise had to face him head on.
"I spent some time working a hydropower installation at Lake Komeno on Mars," she said. "The lead engineer favored using readouts and drones to monitor everything. A pipe burst leading to the turbine. It didn't just cost him his job. It cost people. People I knew, their lives. So understand this. I always walk the project. Okay?"
Whether Elise had been inspecting new buildings in recently terraformed landscapes, or getting down into the dark of the sewers to watch progress firsthand and talk to contractors to get their opinions, it was part of her DNA. Often enough, suited up in the same protective gear as everyone else, she went unrecognized. People gave her honest intel as a result. Factors she could use from the top to improve things. The same would apply here.
"I don't like this," Lamar said.
"You don't have to. I can assure you, I'm not running away from anything. Go back down to the bunker." Elise walked toward the Pelican. "When I get back, I want to see those plans you're working closely with the generals on." Lamar folded his arms. "You told them you wanted to push the Jiral Hanai back off the planet."
Elise nodded. "Yes, I do.
We have to look at things we can achieve, Governor. We won't survive a full press like that."
"Maybe not. But I want to see all the options. We can't cut anything out before we've even begun."
She'd just accepted the fact that she wouldn't be able to make the perfect choice. But she was certainly going to try to make the ones that didn't leave her successors with more impossible decisions. She had to win this war, so they wouldn't have to fight one in the future. Whatever victory looked like now, it would have to lead to better paths down the road, even if it meant great sacrifices up front. Everything has to be on the table, Lamar. Elise turned around and walked up the ramp and into the Pelican. The pilot looked back and gave her a thumbs up. Elise returned the gesture.
"Let's get into the air," she thought.
Another aide, Travis Pope, waved her over to one of the harnessed seats as the Pelican gunned into the sky. They swung around, The heartbreaking sight of the massive Jirohanai cruiser annihilating the previously occupied section of the city, tilting away from her sight. "You wouldn't believe the favors I had to pull to get you this," he shouted to her over the noise of the craft.
"Thank you, Travis."
Elise took a data pad from him and looked over the schedule. "Did you get any of the refugee figures updated?"
"Yes, we're looking at 20,000 who've moved to the farthest edge of the city, Sector 31, away from the Jirohanai's concentration. Militias helping them dig up areas to create temporary housing. They're using Instacrete and sandbags and prefab materials from the early colonial days, trying to create some semblance of safety. The big problem out there is water. They've used some emergency hydro cables to draw from community wells out to the site, but they're basically out in the desert."
"What about food?"
Elise rubbed her eyes. She was fading. "The vertical farms in Sector 24 weren't attacked, so we've got convoys to take anything we can harvest and get them to secure locations. Some of the grains were diverting directly to the camps. We have a few days before we really have to nail the logistics on that, as people are bringing some basics with them. Finley Ice Creams even took several vats of flavors out for the kids. Everyone else is demanding government credit. Redeemable after whatever this all is comes to an end."
After. That was optimistic.
Elise fumbled in her pockets and pulled out a stim patch. She peeled it open and rubbed it onto her forearm. The governor's logistics staff had been scattered among a series of tunnels, fortified basements, and one off-site bunker on the outskirts of the city. They'd done a good job coordinating this response. Elise felt a flash of pride that rode the slow build of the stimulants, returning her energy.
"Governor! Director Pope!" the pilot yelled back at them. "You'll want to see this!"
They yanked their harnesses off and moved up the center of the Pelican. The pilot pointed up through the windows.
"It just started. Check it out. The Jirohanai in orbit are now attacking the Sangheili."
Plasma fire lit up the sheet-like cirrostratus clouds far overhead in the upper atmosphere. It looked like an impossibly high thunderstorm that flashed lightning from cloud to cloud. They couldn't make out the vessels as anything more than specks, but the energy bursting out from them was clear enough. They were watching a vicious suborbital battle, Elise realized.
"Another skirmish in this civil war we've been tracking?" Travis asked.
"There's nothing civil about the Jirohanai," the pilot said. "They were aiding the Sangheili when this whole thing started."
Elise nodded. The alliance between those two groups in orbit may have only lasted as long as it could. She watched the dance of plasma fire and then tapped the pilot on the shoulder.
"Take us back."
"Governor?"
Travis looked down at his copy of the itinerary.
"They've turned on each other.
They're going to be more focused on whatever they're fighting about than us. And two brute cruisers versus the rest of the Sangheili fleet up there? That's going to be a mess. It brings odds down into our favor. We need to make sure we can take advantage of this."
This was a stroke of luck. Elise wasn't going to waste it. Travis didn't look as sure. He followed her back to his seat, grabbing hold of each passing harness as the Pelican looped around the financial district. "The Jirohanai still have that cruiser and a lot of fighters on the ground down here. They didn't seem to need those two other cruisers to raise all the hell we're currently dealing with, ma'am."
"During the war, I heard of humans literally ripped apart by a Jirohanai for looking it in the eye after surrendering. Do you think these creatures are operating based on some rigid, logical strategy? They're loose cannons, animals. They're not like the Sangheili. They're probably making decisions based on emotion and instinct, which is why they're clawing at their benefactors' throats right now. This could be on the verge of falling apart. There's a lot of firepower still out there, Governor. I saw the preliminary reports on their strength. I'm not in the militia, but I can tell we're outmatched," Travis said. "We'll need a definitive strike to turn things around."
Soraka has advantages, Elise thought. Sorakans knew the layout of their own city better than the enemy. Their engineers and planners knew where the sewers and tunnels were,
This was our city. Against the Jirohanai's current air and ground occupation?
Travis looked dubious.
Like I said, we're not fighting anything normal. These things commit atrocities without a second thought,
Ellis said. So we're not going to fight back right away. We're going to start rigging explosives. I want everything that can detonate packed around the occupied areas. We're going to move the militia there. All of it. You'll need to start making plans to get the refugees to take over everything the militia is helping them do out there in the camps, Travis. Got it?
Quickly taking notes, he nodded. Elise leaned in closer. We might not be able to win in a straight battle. But we do need to convince the Jirohanai that staying in our city won't be worth all the trouble we're going to cause them.
Rajka Kassan looked at the constantly updated damage reports. Unwavering Discipline had lost large sections of its hull. Pillars and bulkheads had collapsed as the strain of re-entry twisted the vessel. Plasma fire had ripped through so many sections that Rajka wasn't even sure it could be called a ship as such anymore. He was flying spare parts through the upper reaches of Rakoi's sky. "Our shields are back!" Daga cried out. The horrible shaking eased, and Rajka relaxed slightly.
Good.
He checked the location of the demon's lifeboat, dead ahead, and gave orders to continue the descent to intercept. Two of Tharz's frigates had now caught up to harass Unwavering Discipline. Pure Resolve and Reprisal's fire rained plasma down on the raised shields, but they couldn't do much to the heavy cruiser's strength while simultaneously attempting to keep their own shielding up to prevent the heat of re-entry from puncturing their much thinner hulls. It was just a temporary respite in the battle, Rajka knew, but it was welcome. The constant ship-to-ship warfare while falling out of space had been fierce. Now the remaining vessels had something else to focus on.
Fleetmaster, the Jirohanai cruisers, Daga announced.
What?
Rajka glanced across all the naval strategy holoprojections and focused on scans of the fleet chasing him down out of orbit. Two Jirohanai cruisers were now recklessly slamming their way into the middle of Tharz's ships, shields down, all weapons blazing.
It would appear your cousin's much-vaunted allies have turned on him, Daga crowed,
moving forward to a top-down map of Rakoi's vast desert to better examine the ship movements.
They are not even attempting to survive the journey down, Rajka said in near disbelief.
Pure Resolve's shields flickered, then suddenly died. Bit by bit, debris flaked off until something deep inside exploded, and the ship simply blew apart. Several of the bridge crew craned their heads from below the raised section of the command bridge, trying to see the bizarre turn of events for themselves.
Did I not warn him? Rajka said. The Jirohanai were never to be trusted. Now we all burn together over the skies of Rakoi.
He would have laughed, but Unwavering Discipline's shields fluttered and failed a final time. The atmosphere clawed at their naked hull once more.
Perhaps we are next.
Generators!
Rajka shouted. While the repair crews struggled to see if there was any possibility of reviving the shields, Rajka spat out orders.
Fire on anything trailing behind us. We only need to make it to the surface.
What remained of Unwavering Discipline struggled and wobbled its way down through the clouds, trailing smoke and debris. A dark shadow of wrath bearing down on their prey below.
Chapter 8. The bumblebee cleared the jagged rock teeth of a mountain, snowcaps whipping by just underneath, and then fell out of the sky.
Brace yourselves.
Mike possessed that overly calm way about him that pilots had just before catastrophe. This wasn't his first crash landing. The forward thrusters fired and the bumblebee sank further down. Jai felt his stomach lurch. Through the windows, he could see a distant desert rushing toward them. The lifeboat tilted forward. The scrub of foothills and valleys slipped to face them. They struck and bounced off a rocky incline. The ventral thrusters continued roaring to keep them just above the slope of the hill as they sped downward. Jai glanced backward to see the mountaintops in the airlock's now cracked windows, then twisted forward as a large pond reared up in front of them. With an explosion of spray, the lifeboat struck the water and skipped back into the air, coasting just above the surface. The thrusters kicked them off to the side, narrowly weaving around a column of rock that just grazed the bumblebee. The craft spun slowly, turning sideways in the air as it passed the edge of the pond. The thrusters fired again, and they were flying backward. Jai grabbed the nearest harness to keep steady. Mike blasted the main rear thrusters at full. The craft slowed a little, and then the engines died out. "Out of fuel," Mike said in mock cheer as they dropped yet again. They struck the rocky ground in an explosion of torn-off brush and a wave of dirt. The airlock doors immediately warped and the window glass burst inward at the sudden explosion, the back of the bumblebee buckling. They finally slowed to a grinding stop. Mike immediately started calling for local assistance. "Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot 1. It was difficult to tell how far they had missed the mark and where the city was in relation to their current position. Jai moved to the back of the lifeboat through smoke that was now billowing out of every crevice. He and Adriana kicked once at the mangled airlock doors, rending them from their pressure-locked hinges and sending them sliding across the arid ground. "Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot 1. Jai wrenched the harness off the civilian, who miraculously appeared unharmed, other than by her original injuries. "We have a fire," Jai announced to Mike. "Clear out!" Adriana moved outside, plasma rifle swinging around to make sure there was no trouble waiting for them. Jai followed, carrying the woman in his arms. Mike kicked through the cockpit windows and climbed out to avoid having to negotiate his way through the marred interior and out the back. The smoke now began to pour out of the bulkhead, signaling a chemical fire of some kind in the hull plating. "This fire will be a beacon for anyone who might come looking for us," he said. "We need to put it out." The dance and flicker of orange light grew from breaches in the ivory armor, black smoke pluming out of the wrecked bumblebee in an expanding column. Jai laid the civilian carefully down on a slab of rock. "We hit water on the way down, didn't we?" he asked Mike. "There's a large pond 100 meters ahead. Let's push." Mike grabbed the side of the airlock and dug his armored boots into the ground. Jai put his shoulder to it. Adriana silently slipped in between them and did the same. The bumblebee scraped first slowly, then slid at a decent clip, eventually tumbling like a boulder with each coordinated shove. They'd disregard the safety of causing more volatile damage to the craft, just to get it underwater as soon as possible. It was the first time they'd done something this synchronized when not under fire since Glicky, Jai thought. He missed it, working together without talking or planning, just knowing what the team needed and doing it. They finally managed to shove the bumblebee over the banks and into the large pond, letting it roll down a steep runoff and plunge onto the surface. It burbled and smoked a little before it slipped most of the way under the water, effectively putting out the fire. A vast shadow fell over the mountainside they'd narrowly missed on the way in. Jai leaned back to see a Covenant cruiser thunder overhead. Smoke and flames streamed from rents throughout the hull, and it wobbled as it desperately tried to control its descent. "Damn," Mike said. Pieces of its hull broke free and showered toward the ground, slamming into nearby hills and valleys. Before they could even scatter for cover, it passed on, leaving a trail of black smoke the size of a skyscraper in its wake. It showed zero signs of stopping, or even being able to, but kept on going further toward a mountain range opposite where it finally disappeared beyond the horizon. The faint sound of the impact rolled around the crags and peaks in the distance. "Was that our ship?" Adriana asked, holstering her weapons. "I think it was," Jai guessed. "Look at that," Mike said, his eyes fixed in the other direction, from where the vessel had first appeared. Beyond the mountains and the dark column of smoke left by the cruiser, dozens more ships fell slowly from the sky, like burning angels seeking Earth. Unwavering discipline struck ground, and it was almost as if the ship screamed as it died. The sheared hull elements shrieked in what sounded like anger, and then began a mournful howl as more of the vessel's great belly pressed into the planet's surface, and the ship's insides collapsed floor by floor. The command bridge was almost immediately plunged into darkness, and Rajka Kassan flew across the room, bouncing off the deck like a rag doll until he smacked into a nearby pillar. The roaring of his imploding ship continued for several minutes, even after the cruiser had come to a complete stop. Over the rending and warping, he could hear the occasional muted scream of a dying Sangheili, likely trapped as pieces of the ship fell down or buckled inward. Silence finally fell over them like a gentle cloak. Rajka lay still in the dark. He still lived. Unwavering discipline had lived up to its name and delivered him to the surface despite the hell it had endured. He tried to sit up, but couldn't. Something in the darkness and chaos had pinned him to the floor. Rajka pressed against it, spitting and swearing in his elder's tongue as he pushed. All he did was crush his chest even harder against the cool material. Backup lighting and power somehow flickered on. He was trapped under one of the bridge's large, swooping holoprojector pillars. It was intractably pinned below the command dais, refusing to budge free. He wasn't bleeding, though. Something to be grateful for. Feet thumped around the bridge's wreckage and stopped in front of Rajka. Keza, one of his special operation commanders, stood tall over him. "This is all you're doing," Keza hissed. His energy sword sputtered as motes of swirling dust from the crash struck it. The surviving Sangheili glanced about, nervous, fearing that one of the others would attack him. He also sought to strengthen his own courage. "Now, I must end this madness." Rajka looked around as best as he could. Other surviving Sangheili crew stood by silently, watching the scene unfold. It became clear that they would not stop Keza, even if Rajka ordered it. But they would not help the renegade Sangheili either. This was their way. Combat, even between a superior trapped in wreckage against a subordinate with an overwhelming advantage, was not to be interfered with. Still, Rajka doubted that anyone here would follow Keza. They would likely soon kill him, as he was a weak commander, though clever at times. Rajka had thought him loyal, too. More bad judgment on his part. The Sangheili were not patricidal savages like the Jirohanai. But it was tragically clear that they had much more in common than Rajka would have liked to admit. In war, weak leadership needed, of course, to be rooted out for a clan to survive. Unfortunately for Keza, Rajka would not go so quietly into the night. He still had other scores to settle. "Do you think that Tharz will reward you for killing me? He will kill you as well." Rajka forced himself to focus on moving his right arm. All he needed to do was free it. He pulled so hard he thought he could hear something in his shoulder pop. "You have led us to ruin," Keza screamed, and raised his sword high. "You have done all that you could to destroy us." Rajka managed to find enough purchase with his arm to finally reach his plasma pistol. As Keza swung down, Rajka twisted to pull his limb up and shot the commander in the foot. Keza howled and dropped to his knees. But then he realized his mistake and quickly scrambled to recover, grabbing Rajka's wrist and forcing the pistol's barrel into the air, just as the fleetmaster fired again. The shot veered wide, the plasma bolt splashing against the ceiling. Keza struggled to hold Rajka's arm down while also maneuvering into a killing position.
You should have just killed me and gotten it over with, Rajka jeered, not letting go of the weapon as Kaza tried to break his arm in two. Rajka fired again, just grazing the side of Kaza's head.
Fleetmaster!
Kaza bellowed. I am no longer your fleetmaster. Rajka arched his back, panting, pulling his forearm toward himself. Kaza's sword bit down into Rajka's side as the commander tried to finish what he had started.
I am simply your enemy now.
Both Sangheili roared in fury and pain, each trying to summon one last spasm of strength to finish the other off. Rajka's arm moved a slight, nearly imperceptible twitch closer. He squeezed the trigger and shot Kaza in the face. The commander's right mandibles burned away in an instant, leaving a gaping hole of melted flesh. As Kaza jerked back in horror, eyes wide, Rajka finally yanked his arm free and jammed the muzzle into what remained of Kaza's mouth, pulling the trigger again. Plasma burst out from the inside of Kaza's helmet with a gush of sizzling purple blood. The Sangheili's body toppled forward. Rajka grabbed it, brought it closer, and retrieved the dead traitor's energy sword still in his grip. He activated it, jammed it into the column pinning him, and started cutting, ignoring the molten splashes that seared his skin. When he stood free, he kicked Kaza's body aside and pointed around himself with the sword. His side burned where Kaza had managed to injure him, but the sword had cauterized the wound shut. Rajka ignored it for now. It is fair to attack your leader when you perceive him to be too weak or in grievous error. But I grow tired of those who wait for my back to be turned in order to strike. I am sickened of those who refuse to meet me in combat face to face. The other Sangheili, the ones who provided no aid during the skirmish with Kaza, took a respectful step back. The fleet master nodded. I am Rajka Kassan. I alone created our fleet out of the discarded and forgotten ships. I led us to this new world. We have lost all of that because some will not follow me. So, decide on your path now. Bow to my authority as Kaidon here and follow me to avenge your fellow Sangheili against the Demon Three. Or leave my sight. Make your choice.
Dagger was the one who pulled himself up over the crumpled remains of the command dais and bowed to Rajka first. Then, as one, the rest of the crew present all lowered their heads in submission.
Good, Rajka said, deactivating the weapon. Now let us see what we can salvage from our ship. We still have a hunt in front of us.
From inside the planning room, Elise Gass glanced over the shoulders of General Grace and General Kapoor at the activity within the command bunker. The air here had changed. An anticipatory buzz now floated about, the hushed funereal whispers shifting into nervous, determined chatter. The generals that had previously approached her with grim faces now had purpose in their stride. They could all feel the sense of possibility here. That she was right. They would take advantage of this turn of affairs and exploit this weakness to make Soraka an utter quagmire for the Jirohanai. Their enemies would not take the city from her. Several proposals floated on the screens around the planning room, as well as on paper. Old emergency schemes for dealing with UNSC occupation that had been kept hidden since the pre-war days. Civilians throwing bombs, rigging buildings to blow, then escaping through sewers. Sneak attacks. Guerrilla warfare. Engineers came in and out of the meeting rooms with more diagrams and blueprints of the area the Jirohanai occupied. We've retrieved the thermobaric bombs from the high security facility on the other side of the underground complex, one lieutenant reported, patching in from the field. All 12 functioning excavation-grade explosives are now in place. They've been strategically distributed by scouting teams. At their current position, When they detonate, they'll completely eliminate all enemy activity at the edge of the occupied area, but will not directly affect the majority of the city apart from anticipated collateral damage.
We can get at most of the Jirohanai on the surface with the bombs, General Grace said, but there's still the matter of the cruiser above the city. They'll have a secondary force in there ready to deploy, perhaps more, and they can glass us from the air, obviously.
Travis Pope knocked gently on the window that looked into the planning room. Elise shook her head. Now wasn't the time.
There are some strategies on file that might be worth considering for the second wave, General Kapoor said, opening his briefcase.
Pope slipped in through the door and ghosted over to Elise's elbow.
Governor, I think you need to come with me, he said in a low voice.
What is it? She asked, annoyed. The two generals had stopped talking and now stared at them.
It's best if I speak to you somewhere private.
Something in his voice convinced her to follow him outside.
I'll be right back, she told Kapoor and Grace.
They looked annoyed at the interruption. They had people to lead, preparations to make, but they relented nonetheless.
Of course, Governor.
She stood and left the room with Travis.
I'm really sorry for the intrusion,
Travis whispered as he moved her through the command bunker toward her temporary office.
But we should discuss this away from everybody.
Lamar was already there, waiting inside. He stood up as she entered and Travis stayed back, closing the door behind her.
Lamar, what's going on?
Governor, there's an after-action report, he said. I've been holding on to it for confirmation.
After-action report about what?
Okay.
Lamar blew out a breath.
It's from a survivor. Someone from Jeff's squad. She's the only one who made it.
Oh, God. What happened?
Alice grabbed the edge of the desk to hold herself steady.
Tell me what happened, Lamar.
But she already knew. The Jirohanai captured him during an engagement, he said with a solemn face.
Local command is listing Jeff as KIA. They don't have physical confirmation. But there's virtually zero probability that he survived based on the eyewitness account.
Elise slowly nodded as her worst fears came true.
The world faded until it was just her own breathing and Lamar's presence before her.
And they've taken no prisoners so far?
You're sure about this?
Yes, we're sure. They've taken no prisoners.
Why wasn't I told earlier?
This is not something I wanted you to hear from anyone else. I wanted some kind of confirmation before telling you. This is the best I could get.
Lamar took a step closer. His hand closed gently on her shoulder.
I am so, so very sorry for your loss.
But it wasn't her loss, Elise thought. It was Jeff's.
Her son would never get to know anything else. A whole future had been extinguished.
Her son had been extinguished.
A light that had been so bright. The smile, the sound of his laughter. She kept thinking about his wide eyes.
She could still see the 9-year-old child covered in soot with a blanket wrapped around him as they evacuated to bomb shelters on the reserve when the Covenant first arrived on Mars.
You're going to be okay, she had kept saying. It's going to be okay.
A lie.
Please leave, she told Lamar.
I need a moment.
He exited without another word. After she closed the door hard, Elise grabbed the guest chair and threw it against the wall.
It didn't break.
It needed to break. She picked it up again and swung it against her desk. Screens flew off the surface and shattered on the floor.
Not better, but certainly satisfying.
She launched the chair against the window, the view there on one of the underground loading bays. She saw a handful of passers-by outside flinch as it struck.
The safety glass starred and fragmented, but hung together. Lamar just stood there in the corridor outside, his back to her, almost at parade rest. Travis remained there as well, looking down at the ground, hands folded in front of him, waiting. Elise closed her eyes and wiped the tears away with the back of her hand. She was not the only mother who had lost a child in Soraka. She needed to be stronger than this. But that burst of rage and grief made her feel even weaker than she had before. Elise took a deep breath and composed herself, warding off other thoughts of Jeff, and summoning what little of her strength remained. She opened the door and tapped her waiting second-in-command on the shoulder. Lamar, come with me. I need you with me in the planning session. Governor? We have very little time, Elise said, striding back toward the conference room, blinking her scratchy eyes. Generals Grace and Kapoor stood up when she re-entered. Governor, we've been told, said Grace. Our condolences. Recall our ships from Kirikan, Elise said. Issue it as an executive order directly from me to their naval commanders through our closed-band comm relay. We can't remain cowering here, letting them tear into us piece by piece. We need to strike while they're still focused on their skirmish with the Sangheili. We've got their ground forces covered by the bombs. Let's take off their head, she said, pointing to the cruiser's beacon on the holographic map, with whatever naval strength we've got left. Grace and Kapoor looked at each other with uncertainty. Governor, Kapoor said, you've just received devastating news. This might not be the best time to... We are under the occupation by an enemy military force that has the ability to kill every man, woman, and child in this city whenever they are disposed to. There is no best time, Elise said wearily. Kapoor hesitated, then said, We agreed to hold the ships back for reserves. And now we need those reserves. Elise calmly looked them all in the eye. We will not be given a better window of opportunity. It's not the time to be cautious. It is the time to strike back. I'm not saying this because I just found out my son died. I'm saying this because we need to use everything we have to dislodge them from our world, or everything we've sacrificed will have been in vain. Recall the ships. Now. Grace nodded. Yes, Governor. The Jirohanai would pay in blood for blood, Elise thought. It was time to stop worrying about elegant solutions and to speak the language of violence. Chapter 9. A Nexus scrambled up the remains of a collapsed building near one of the taller barricades that Hecabe was using to observe progress. For a moment, the Jirohanai warrior paused to look behind Hecabe, and out over the glassed area a kilometer away, now beginning to dip slightly as the molten earth compressed downward. Report, Hecabe ordered. A Nexus nervously whipped around. Three Sangheili frigates remain in orbit, but they are barely functional. They will not be able to attack us here. We have truly taken this world for ourselves, Chieftain. Hecabe rubbed the top of his gravity hammer thoughtfully. He was not interested in this world. He was interested in what was inside it. The price. Their other vessels have all crashed into the mountains that hem the desert. They are far removed from this city. Hammer strike and fighter's blood have fallen with them. Perhaps we should send the Phobane to the site to recover any survivors and weapons. No, we will need it for transport soon enough. Phobane is sufficient for what is left of our purposes here. These humans, with their pitiful strength, will not be able to harm a Jirohanai heavy cruiser. Have any Sangheili survived?
Hecabe caught a whiff of anxiety from a Nexus that told him more than words could.
Some. But we have the planet. We have the Phobane, and our cruiser can destroy the enemy from the air whenever we choose, Anexus said, evidently overcompensating for any perceived weakness he'd shown earlier.
They will not be able to disturb us. Our clan is strong.
Strong, Hecabe mused. We say that. But when the humans and Sangheili joined forces, they hunted down what remained of our ships. They struck us down with impunity. Even those who fled back to Doysak. They attacked without parley or mercy. They destroyed the very ships that protected our bloodline. Anexus, our clan's lineage may die with us. Do you still dare to say that we are strong?
Anexus did not know how to respond. He clearly wished to be anywhere else but here right now.
Hecabe sighed. What I mean is this. Do you truly think any surviving Sangheili will just stay put where they landed? And those that ally with the humans, will they remain weakened now that they are on the humans' world?
Anexus looked down at the ground near Hecabe's feet.
No, chieftain. They will seek revenge.
Hecabe paused, but Anexus did not react.
So we will need to strike first to protect ourselves, before they have a chance to gather their forces. Send whatever remains of the Yungoy and 300 warriors out to meet them now.
The Yungoy are all dead. You ordered,
Hecabe growled. Then our warriors will have to suffice.
Anexus backed down the hill.
Of course, chieftain. What about the humans who remain in this city? We will be vulnerable with little protection.
Hecabe caressed his gravity hammer.
The humans are of no concern. We will have 50 Jirohana here. And we will have the Phobane. Or are you frightened? Never,
Anexus said, anger dripping from his voice at the suggestion.
Then send out the packs. Nothing crosses the desert between the mountains and the human city. Do you understand? Nothing can be allowed to stop our progress here.
How much deeper can we dig?
Anexus asked.
This planet. We will soon dig into the molten rock if we keep going. Maybe what you seek is not here.
Oh. It is here,
Hecabe said.
We are close, Anexus. Our time has almost come.
There were now only 3 Sangheili frigates left in orbit. Governor Elise looked at the reports in her office. Could they realistically engage them? Soraka's 12 surviving ships were armed but had no magnetic accelerator cannons. Max had been the UNSC's weapon of choice during the war against the Covenant. Only a slug launched by a remarkably long coil of magnets and powered by a ship's engines could penetrate Covenant shields. But despite not having Max, Soraka's ships did have retrofitted point defense guns welded onto the outer structures. That had to count for something, if they now outnumbered the Sangheili ships. A swarm of lightly armored merchant ships versus 3 disabled Sangheili frigates that had just been in an intense fight with the Jirohana. It was a long shot. Sangheili ships were notoriously hard to hit, but they hadn't come to the surface when the others fell into the ult. All indications hinted that they were crippled. Elise couldn't pass up the chance. Lamar entered her office and closed the door behind him.
Governor.
He was calling her by title mostly now, she noticed.
We're not scheduled to meet for another 15 minutes, Elise said, irritation creeping into her voice.
I didn't want to say this in front of General Grace. He stood in front of her desk in an odd way.
Formal.
I've been reading over the last hour's intel. Elise stood up as well. She walked around the desk and tapped on the holodisplay's file cache, bringing up the reports. I've been poring over them too. It was right to recall our ships. We have an opening. Lamar nodded, but didn't relax his posture. An opening? But to do what with? Until now we've been under attack and fighting back where we could, figuring out what was happening. Now we have a moment to breathe, but we're still in fight mode. I know it's a bit late, and it's not on our contingency plans, but I strongly believe we should take a closer look at evacuating any civilians we can with the assets we have. Contingency plans never expected the loss of all our slipstream-enabled ships. I agree we need to recall the ships, but I do not believe we should attack the Jirohanae, or the Sangheili for that matter. Now is the time to use those ships to evacuate Sorakans. We need to protect our civilians while we've got this window, while the brutes and elites are focused on each other. So this was what had been eating him up for the last few hours. Elise swiped the holo display and brought a pane into view, showing a number of images pulled from close-band relays high above the planet's surface. Did you see the satellite feed of the crash sites? Lamar glanced at it. Not yet. The Sangheili survived. Both sides. But they are grounded. Many of them are heading deeper into the desert. They're moving toward Soraka, which is why we need to evacuate. Elise slapped the holodisplay's sensor, collapsing the images. There are a million people in Soraka, Vice Governor. If he was going to go on title, she could return the damn favor. 1 million. How many people can we evacuate from the surface with 12 merchant ships? 70,000? Standing side by side in cargo holds? And I don't think I have to ask you, but where do they go? The Sangheili targeted everything with slipspace capabilities. They did this for a reason. We do this, and we condemn those citizens to being crammed into ships, to wait in orbit until the aliens shoot them out of the sky, or until they run out of air, whichever comes first. Are we going to force them to evacuate? To become refugees again? They've already been through this. It's a chance for life, Lamar snapped. Once they get into orbit and away, there's an opportunity they can wait for rescue. Who the hell is coming? Elise asked. Our contacts in the new Colonial Alliance? They're engaged in battles of their own, and over the last 3 months, we've been tenuous allies at best. When we agreed to work with the UNSC and the Sangheili for peace here, the NCA stopped talking to us. If anything, we're probably on their list too. The UNSC had an envoy in that Sangheili fleet. They're sure as hell going to come looking for her. For one person? Yeah. Eventually, they'll send one little ship to extract her, if she was even still alive. They've made an investment in getting us peace with the Sangheili, Governor. This conflict puts them at odds with the Arbiter, and it places their entire alliance on shaky ground. They won't just let the dust settle. They've got stakes in this thing. But without communications, all they know is that things have gone dark. Earth has its own issues to deal with, Vice Governor. This will be a political nightmare for them. They want peace with the Sangheili. They'll give us up in a heartbeat for a chance to keep the Arbiter's people by their side. Evacuation is not a good chance, but it's still a chance. Lamar stabbed his finger at her. And what about those left behind? Evacuate as many as we can to the oases. Azar Oasis, Herndon Lake, Fallen Tree. There are places they can shelter. To be hunted down later. We take your path, then we risk everything. If we fail to stop either side, we effectively doom everyone. whether by the boots of the Jirohanai or the swords of the Sangheili. Don't forget, there are still plenty of fighting Sangheili over in Rak who could cross the Ult for our heads overnight. That's in addition to the ones already headed this way. You'd leave most of us stranded and defenseless with your plan, Elise shot back. It's foolish.
It's at least something. Lamar's voice cooled. It's better than sacrificing us all for a personal act of vengeance.
Vengeance? Elise cocked her head. Is that what you think this is?
He couldn't meet her eyes, but looked behind her at a point on the wall. You just lost your son.
Lamar.
She kept her voice level and calm, but she hit the desk with the palm of her hand.
How the hell could you say something like that to me? I didn't lose my senses. I am grieving, but it has not overwhelmed my ability to look at the facts we face.
It's too great a price to pay for the opportunity to gain airstrike abilities, Lamar stated, but less strongly now.
Could be.
Elise grabbed his shoulder.
Or it could be our chance to secure this world despite everything that stands against us. If we don't try this, we guarantee that we'll remain weak and at their mercy. Especially if we just try to hide and wait this out. Coming here, it was a gamble. Deep down, we've all known this. We knew it wouldn't be easy.
But we don't need to compound the risk. We've been at peace since we arrived here, Governor.
We were fooled because those first years went so easily, Elise said. But now, we have to decide whether Soraka lives or dies, whether this world is ours, or whether we hand it over to these creatures and just give up, whether this world becomes Rakoi for good, and the Kera we've fought and died for fades into memory.
Lamar rubbed his forehead. I've been at war for so long, Governor.
UNSC? Covenant?
I just want to stop seeing bodies in my dreams. I thought I could get away from it here, help you build something different. And now I'm being asked to do it all over again.
She squeezed his shoulder. Lamar, we'll do this together. I need you to stand with me. I need your wisdom, your advice. I can't fight you and these monsters alone. I just can't.
They both leaned against the desk. Lamar wiped the corner of an eye.
Okay. Also, please stop calling me Governor, dammit.
We're not going through hell and back just to have you refer to me by my title. He laughed.
Sorry. Old grunt's habit. Old habits are easy to fall back on.
Lamar took a deep breath.
Briefing then. I'll follow in a minute. Looks like Pope is all but jumping up and down by the window to get my attention.
Elise watched Lamar walk out. She let out a deep sigh and rubbed her hands. Travis took the opportunity and quickly slipped in.
Governor, there was a mayday from a lifeboat. The officers who received it are debating whether or not to take it seriously or if it's a Sangheili ploy. The call came from the Carfu mountain range. It's an old UNSC channel.
So there might have been a UNSC ship in that battle? Elise asked.
Maybe they were keeping an eye on the proceedings. Oni might have been up to something.
It's odd. The lifeboat's call sign is a bit strange, too. One of the operators thought it might be a joke. The call sign is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot 1.
That has got to be human.
Travis nodded earnestly.
That's what I thought. Can we spare some patrols to head out into the desert and sniff around? Wait a second. Is this even on the briefing agenda?
No. But someone I know on the front lines was worried it wouldn't get up the command chain to the generals quickly enough due to the chaos. They back-channeled the intel to me.
Keep this off any agendas for now, Elise said. I'll talk to General Kapoor afterward. And please keep it to yourself as well. At least until we know for sure if it's real and who made the call. Okay? She didn't want Lamar reversing course to go back to clinging to the hope that the UNSC would suddenly arrive to save them all. They couldn't afford that.